In spring, millions of songbirds migrate north across the Gulf of Mexico from the Yucatan to the southeastern U.S. One author describes this crossing as one of the greatest crapshoots in bird migration. When the weather is fair and tailwinds strong, the flight, while metabolically taxing, is completed quite handily. But when birds encounter rainstorms or headwinds, they struggle mightily, and many may die. After fighting sustained bad weather, birds reaching the U.S. coast are exhausted and famished. They drop into the nearest shrubs and trees by the thousands. Picture a shrub loaded with colorful tanagers and orioles, such as these orchard orioles. Or a tree full of brilliant warblers. These are Tennessee warblers. But why risk exhaustion or a watery demise when birds could instead migrate north along the length of Mexico? It's likely that many birds evolved to take the potentially perilous Transgulf route because it is direct and considerably faster. The Transgulf flight saves nearly a week of travel time, putting birds on the best breeding territories more quickly and thus increasing their chances of raising more young. Find more about Transgulf migration at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJSF 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
We are no longer living in a world of our grandmothers and grandfathers, or even our fathers and mothers. How might we be nimble enough to meet the complexity of these challenging times? How might we be courageous in the face of uncertainty while engaging difficult situations without giving up? How might we be serenely ready for what life asks of us, able to respond without collapsing into anxiety or resignation? Today we'll be exploring the art of serene readiness, how to be quietly steady while we create, relate, love, act, and do good in the world, with our guest, Dr. Eric Maisel, a pioneering creativity coach and author of more than 50 books on creativity, meaning, and mental wellness. Eric Maisel is a retired licensed psychotherapist and an internationally respected coach specializing in creativity, existential wellness, and relationship coaching. He trains coaches and offers workshops and webinars nationally and internationally, and he's the author of more than 50 books and also writes the long-running Rethinking Mental Health blog for Psychology Today and contributes to outlets such as The Good Men Project and Fine Art America. His most recent book is Brave New Mind, The Art of Serene Readiness. So please join us for the next hour as we explore a compelling path forward in dealing with the pressures of today's world with our guest, Dr. Eric Maisel. I'm speaking with Eric from his home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Eric, welcome today.
Hi, Justine. It's wonderful to be with you.
It's great to have you here once more. And this particular subject is very, very pertinent to today's world. And I'd love to talk about, first of all, the two words you put together, serene readiness. But I'd like to start with just the first word, serene, serenity. So let's talk about, what do you mean by serenity?
I think the way into that subject is maybe the following. A lot of people understand that they want to be calmer, that they're too anxious, that the world is making them anxious. And maybe they have a meditation practice, maybe they know this or that to do. But most people don't have any portable tactics or practices that actually work when they get anxious. Maybe they have a wonderful half-hour meditation practice in the morning, but that doesn't help them if something happens in the afternoon necessarily. So I think the serenity I'm talking about is really the ability to acquire one or two or three useful, portable anxiety management tools that actually work for you. A lot of people have read books, and then it goes in one ear and out the other. They read the relaxation response or this or that, but they don't really own anything. So for me, what serenity means is something very simple, and that's acquiring one or two or three practices that actually calm you, that actually reduce your anxiety. One idea is to visualize your mind as a room. I did a book on this called Redesign Your Mind, where the idea was actually looking at your mind as if it was a room and redesigning it, redecorating it, taking out that bed of nails and putting in a comfy chair or putting in some windows so that a breeze could blow through. Well, one of the visualizations that one could try is when you enter the room that is your mind, have a switch that both lights the room and that also acts as a calmness switch. Some very, very simple ideas about what to try. I don't really believe that anybody can take in big philosophies, but we can try some small things, tactics, ceremonies, things of a certain size. And so that's the serenity part, is learning how to be calm in the moment, not abstractly, not just during our meditation practice, but at Thanksgiving dinner or at those times when, if we're performing, or those times when we're not naturally calm, to be calm then. That's the serenity piece. And I don't think people, to say this one way, don't really try hard enough to be calm.
I also think of serenity can be composed under pressure, you know.
Yes.
Or even cheerful.
That's right. And we know the serenity prayer has to do with understanding the world, understanding human nature, understanding what we can control and what we can't control. We'll talk about readiness in a moment, but it's also partly about no longer being surprised by those things that should no longer surprise us. We keep getting surprised by the same thing, that our mate says something for the thousandth time and we're surprised that they've said it again. So I think serenity has to do a lot with that very well-known idea of figuring out what we can control and really releasing and detaching from that which we can't control.
Well said, well said. So going on to readiness and what that means for you.
Sure. It's an obvious idea, and yet people don't realize the extent to which they are not ready for X, whatever X is. I'll give you an example out of my practice, because mostly I work with creative performing artists. I've been doing this for 30 or 40 years. And they are not ready to make the following switch, and they've really never thought about the following switch. All day long, they're supposed to do things right, drive on the right side of the road, pick up their kids at 3, mow the lawn, do one right thing after another. That's appropriate. That's not inappropriate. But then somehow a time is supposed to come where they have real permission to make mistakes and messes. That's the creative process. And most human beings find they're not ready for that other moment. They're not ready to go into the unknown and will themselves to engage in process, do whatever comes up, make a mistake, spend 2 years on a book that doesn't work. Who wants to hear that? But that's what we need to be serenely calm enough to do as creative people, is to engage in process and every day make this shift from getting things right to letting go of getting things right and having genuine permission. Not just everyone has intellectual permission to make mistakes and messes. We can all say it as a sentence. But most people really do not like that feeling. And it's not a little mistake necessarily. It can be the kind of mistake I just mentioned, like spending a couple of years on a project that doesn't work, a screenplay, a film. It's very hard to embrace that reality and to be serene embracing that reality. But those are the kinds of realities that we need to be ready for.
Well, I'm thinking also being ready, it's beyond just being at the starting line, you know, but never getting into the race, so
That's
to speak.
Right.
So I think you talk about readiness is not only is it a quality of being, it's also a process. It's also an action.
It's an action. It's a stance also. The starting line imagery makes me think of that stance, the three-point stance of a runner. But I think a good analogy of the stance is the following. If you're playing basketball and you don't have the ball, you're not surprised if the ball comes to you. You're ready for the ball to come to you. You may be doing nothing in particular. You may be standing around or running down the court or something. You don't have the ball in your hands, but you're not surprised when it comes. Kids, young kids are surprised when the ball comes to them. We as adults should stop being surprised by that. That's the kind of readiness I'm talking about, where we're not yet doing the thing, but we know the thing is coming. Or we know the thing may be coming. We may not be the person who's passed the ball, but we might be. So we're ready for that. And there are lots of times in the day, in life, when we need to be ready in that way. The thing that we're ready for may not happen, but it may happen, and we don't want to be surprised by it.
So what I'm thinking is we may not have all the answers in what's coming to us. So it's not a matter of understanding, oh, the ball's going to come to me and I'm going to do this or that or the other. If the ball comes to me, who knows
That's right.
what the court is going to look like.
That's right. And we're connecting this up to ideas of uncertainty and ambiguity, aren't we? Because we can't be ready for answers or certainty or that stuff we're wanting. We can want that, but that's not what's coming. What's coming is confusion, complexity, chaos. That's what everyone's experiencing. I was thinking a lot about the following question. Is our brain equal to this moment? That's kind of where this book comes from. Is our brain, why should we believe that our brain is actually equal to this moment? Evolution takes time, like millions of years, not like 3 months. We've changed lifespan in the 1600s. Lifespan was 30-ish. In the 1700s, it was 30-ish. In the 1800s, it was 30-ish. The 1900s, it was still 30 to 40. Not a gigantic improvement. Now we've made vast inroads with clean water and dentistry and all kinds of things. What about the brain? So our lifespan has changed. Has our brain changed? I don't think so. I don't think our brain has caught up with where we are.
I know our brain really craves simplicity and simple answers. And yet the world, as you say, is more and more complex.
Yeah, the brain does want slogans, and existentialists fight against slogans. Sartre gives the famous example, the simple example of a young man who has to make the choice between going off to war or taking care of his invalid mother. There's nothing simple about that. There's no slogan to use there. There's no right answer, actually. There's going to be disappointment and grief and this and that, no matter which way you choose. That's maturity, to not think there's a right answer. War, that's the right answer, or mother, that's the right answer. It can't be like that. It's more complicated than that. It's more nuanced. And these are the sorts of decisions or complexities that we need to be ready for.
Some of the blocks to that readiness could be like a procrastination is a big one, or addiction to perfection might be one. What are some of those things that block us from?
The biggest one is how we talk to ourselves. That's the biggest one. This is well known. Cognitive therapy is based on the idea that we're self-unfriendly and that what we're saying doesn't serve us. I think what isn't that well known, everybody knows that negative self-talk is probably not a good idea, that's not serving us. What people understand a little less well is that true thoughts may not be serving us. We think if a thought's true, then we should countenance it, but there's no reason to. What I mean is, let's say you're a writer and you walk into a bookstore and you say to yourself, wow, there are a lot of writers out there. I don't think I should write a book. There are just so many writers. It is a true thought that there are a lot of writers out there. That's the truth. But to stick with that thought prevents you from getting your own work done. So there are lots of true kinds of thoughts where we have to say, that's true, but it doesn't serve me to think that. I have to dispute it, not its veracity. Can't dispute the veracity. There are a lot of writers out there. What I have to dispute is what it's doing to me to think that. And that's another form of readiness. You walk into a bookstore, what writer is prepared to be depressed by that experience? They're prepared to be joyous. But a lot of writers get depressed. You should be ready for that. We should know ourselves well enough to know what's coming.
Exactly. So that just takes us to, I think, your four-legged stool, and you've been talking a bit about it already. And this is that stool that you use the image of your grandmother had a...
Grandfather, actually.
Oh, your grandfather.
He was in the garment industry, and he had a little stool for, you know, measuring the length of pant legs or what have you.
And it was a four-legged stool, and that gives us support, big support.
It gives us big support. Let me circle around and make sure. I want to make sure I get a few things expressed that connect to both serenity and readiness. So we've had a couple of thousand years of two metaphors that have not served us. One is the purpose of life, and the other is the meaning of life. And people are still, to this day, stuck believing that there might be a purpose to life, or there might be a meaning to life. And they're not quite ready to understand or contemplate the paradigm shift to multiple life purposes, that many things are important to us. There isn't a particular purpose to life. There are the things that are important to us, our menu of life purposes. And then the really interesting but difficult to comprehend idea that meaning is just a feeling. You attend a lecture, you find it meaningful. I attend a lecture, I don't find it meaningful. It's personal. It's just we have a different feeling in that experience. There's nothing out there that is meaningful. If you get this idea, which can go in one ear and out the other, that meaning is just a feeling, if you get the idea, though, then you realize that meaning, like all feelings, must come and go. It's not a tragedy or a crisis if meaning leaves. It'll come back on Tuesday. But we get all worked up when meaning leaves. I'm pausing for effect here because it's such a big deal idea. We've gotten so attached to the problem of meaninglessness rather than understanding that we should be interested in our life purposes and living them, and much less interested in the question of meaning. Forget about meaning. It'll come back. And if it doesn't come back, there are 60 or 80 pathways to the reenchantment of meaning, things you can try to invite it back. There are all kinds of things you can do around creativity or family or activism or service. We can name them, run down the list. There are things to bring meaning back, but relax. If meaning's gone for 3 days or a month, live your life purposes. Do the things that are important to you, irrespective of whether they generate the experience of meaning or not. So I know I'm saying many big things quickly. This is where people are not ready. They're not ready to understand purpose well enough. They're not understanding meaning well enough, those two things.
Meaning, from what you're saying, is a movable feast.
It's a movable feast. It's a psychological experience. We don't experience the same thing as, we don't even experience our kids as meaningful all the time. The experience of meaning shifts, and especially with this complicated world. Let's give you another kind of example. We might be believing in the war we're fighting in any given moment, and then we get new information, and now we're against the war we're fighting. Those kinds of shifts. The war was meaningful. Now it's the opposite of meaningful. It's still a profound thing, but it's no longer something that we want to support. So these kinds of shifts really disturb our equilibrium, and it takes us a long time to notice that meaning has left some big enterprise of ours. I interviewed a lot of interesting people once who were sort of well-known in their fields, and it came up that meaning had drained out of a certain enterprise in their life. Like, for one nun, she'd lost belief in God and her order. That was a big meaning drain. For another who had tenure, a faculty member, he no longer was interested in his classes. And it's hard to give up tenure, as we all know. That's security, etc. And then there were relationship difficulties. Well, here's the headline. It took each one of these adult people, smart people, creative people, on order, 5 years to make the change they knew they were going to make. 5 years to leave the order, 5 years to give up tenure, 5 years to leave the marriage. It takes us a long time to deal with the fallout of meaning draining out of the enterprise. And during that time, we're not okay. We're not well during that whole period because we know the thing we're doing is no longer meaningful to us. We should try another pathway to meaning. We know that, but we're stuck.
It occurs to me, oh, this no longer has meaning for me. Let's say the nun and the order and believing in God. I mean, big one. And so that tendency then to descend into the one of the epidemics of like depression or anxiety or despair.
That's right. And just being scared to look at what this means. Let's say it's divorce. Maybe you're scared to look at lost income, that you're going to end up in poverty.
That's a big one.
It's a big one. So there are consequences to the changes that we have to, again, this is about readiness. We have to be ready for the truth of consequences. That's not a good place of denial to make believe that there will be no consequences to our actions. There will be consequences. And then you sort of brought up bravery to begin with. That's the bravery we're talking about. This is the courage we're talking about, the courage to understand that there will be consequences.
You're saying to go ahead and embrace that. It leads to creativity, I believe.
It leads to creativity, but it also leads to coherence. We don't feel whole if we're just going through the motions. So many people are both super busy and going through the motions simultaneously, and it just doesn't feel good. You say it leads to one of those epidemics, but there are multiple epidemics, as you were alluding to. There is depression, there is anxiety, there is addiction. There's also insomnia and job dissatisfaction and all kinds of somatic complaints with no names, all kinds of illnesses and stomach troubles and this is and that's without names. So many kinds of epidemics, from my point of view, arising from this problem of not being aligned in the meaning and purpose place.
That leads me to say, in this culture, in this time, we are medicalizing everything. There's a pill for everything. So
your eyebrows are too short. Your eyelashes are too long.
Exactly. Yes. And so you fix them, you go to someone and do permanent eyelashes, or you take a pill for, you know, whatever it is that is bothering you, depression or whatever. But that just is kind of covering over.
The thing you're talking about is a very big problem. I'm the commissioning editor for a series called the Ethics International Press Critical Psychology and Critical Psychiatry series, where we look at the illegitimacy of psychiatry and the mental disorder model. And so this is a big subject, hard to broach in 3 seconds flat. But we don't believe that the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, really does what it purports to do. We don't believe that psychiatrists or other practitioners who use this model are actually diagnosing anything or treating anything. They're labeling things, and they're providing chemicals with powerful effects, which is very different from diagnosing and treating. So this is a huge subject. Really, all I'm doing is ratifying and affirming what you're saying about the medicalization of everything. By the way, anybody who watches TV knows that 2 out of 3 ads now are from Big Pharma. Every second we're bombarded. They don't even bother to tell you what the initials are that of the disease they're talking about. It's EFT and ZGQ and PR. Well, let's take it anyway. It's probably good for us somehow. And people, unfortunately, are colluding in this because they like to have a name. So many of my clients are now coming forward and saying, I'm on the spectrum, or I have ADHD. It's a way of understanding themselves and trying to arrive at some destination from all of this troubled thinking over the years of who am I, what's going on, why am I having so many troubles? Oh, it's the ADHD. So it's comforting, but unfortunately, it's not really helpful.
I heard you say arriving at a destination. We're looking to arrive at a destination.
Yep.
But I think throughout your writing, it's all about the journey. It's not some ultimate, okay, we're going to arrive at serenity and be ready. And
that's right. It's all process. And let's just spend a moment there for our listeners who are creative folks. If I were to say honor the creative process, it would absolutely go in one ear and out the other. There'd be nothing there, just be a set of words. But there really is a process to be honored, one of which is the one I mentioned before about we have to be tolerant of mistakes and messes. Another is that we have to be tolerant of our ordinary work. And this is a big deal problem for creative people. They're easy with somebody else's ordinary work. They'll read a book and say, that was okay. That was fine. Listen to a piece of music. That was fine. Go to a movie. That was fine. I enjoyed it. About their own work, ordinariness is not okay. It needs to be at a higher bar. And so they're losing joy in 86% of their work. That's ordinary. If you think about it, I don't know if you're a fan of Bach cantatas. There are hundreds of them, and 15 are wonderful. And 163 are ordinary. Beethoven's symphonies, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9 are supposedly better than 2, 4, 6, 8. You can't do 9 without 8. You can't do 8 without 7. You can't skip the things that are ordinary or don't work. And an awful lot of would-be creative people are sitting there waiting for a guarantee that the thing they're about to do is going to be okay. No guarantee coming. No guarantee coming. Can't have it. Plus, it would probably kill the creative urge anyway to have that guarantee. One of the ways that creative people try to get that guarantee is to repeat their signature work. Keep making the same painting or keep writing the same story because they know how to do that. There is a sort of guarantee there that they can do something. So saying many things simultaneously, but the main thing here is that, as you were saying, there is no destination. There's no, for someone my age and people that I know, there's no retirement. It's just meaning goes on and purpose goes on and the things that matter to us go on. We can't stop doing because we hit a certain designated age to, what, play golf? I don't think so.
I'm just thinking in my group of friends, people have retired from their particular work.
Sure.
But I'm noticing they're busier than ever. It's not retirement from life at all. In fact, they're more engaged.
We have these needs. We have these life purpose needs. But by the way, when I mentioned earlier that I think that there is a really profound shift people need to make between believing that there is a singular purpose to life to the idea that there are life purposes, I believe in that shift. But that doesn't mean that all of those life purposes can't be condensed or coalesced into a life purpose statement that becomes very grounding and very anchoring. My life purpose statement is a very simple one: do the next right thing. For me, that has a lot of meaning. It wouldn't have the same meaning for somebody else, but I know what that means for me. So I think that that's an interesting, whatever to call it, task or opportunity to really try to come up with those 5 or 6 or 7 words that somehow represent all of our many life purposes.
Exactly. I want to talk more about that in just one moment. I want to remind our listeners, I'm here with Eric Maisel, and he is the author of Brave New Mind, The Art of Serene
readiness.